Walter, this all started back in the summer of 1998 with a disabled dog, a Gordon Setter named Shelby. What happened?
Okay, in 1998 in the summer, the Livingston, Montana Humane Society got in a dog that couldn't walk. It had been run over by a car, and it needed the assistance of a wheelchair. It was, you know, a dog that needed a special owner who could pay a lot of attention to it. So they put it up for adoption on the internet and got a response from New York City from a fellow who called himself Clark Rockefeller saying, "I'd love to take care of this dog. I have another Gordon Setter. I have a private chef who gives my dogs four-course meals. I, in fact, live next door to Tony Bennett, who serenades my dogs sometimes. But there's one problem. I don't drive, so I can't come pick it up. And my private jet's in China with my wife. So what are we going to do?"
Yeah.
They came to me and they said, "You lived on the East Coast. Maybe you can talk to this Rockefeller character." And once I talked to him and realized what an eccentric he was, I made the decision to drive the dog myself from Montana in my pickup truck to Central Park South, or near there, in New York City.
Yeah, which is not just a short drive. This is a major undertaking, and you haven't met
2,000 miles.
Yeah, and you haven't met the guy, yet you agreed to do it. Was it because you mentioned that you found him to be eccentric and his last name was Rockefeller? Did you see him being a writer, a journalist, and a novelist? Did this seem like grist for the mill? Is that why you agreed to do it?
Short answer, yeah. It seemed like life was handing me a story. You know, there was a book called Travels with Charlie that John Steinbeck wrote about driving around America with his dog. And here I was going to be delivering a dog across country to a Rockefeller, driving through the Dakotas and then down through Chicago and over through Pennsylvania. And I thought, there has got to be a little novella or a nonfiction book in this.
Yeah.
But also I wanted to win for the Humane Society what I thought would be a big contribution from this Rockefeller, who would be so grateful for this favor.
Right. And also you felt a bit of guilt, didn't you, because you had accidentally run over and killed a dog from that Humane Society?
Well, you know, I had, with that very truck, about a month before this, hit a dog that was staying out at my ranch from the Humane Society and killed it. It had died in my arms.
Oh, dear.
And at some level, I was, I think, trying to redeem myself.
Now, you didn't end up driving the dog all the way to New York City, and your mother, of course, had something to do with this. You stopped to visit her in Minnesota at the time, and you ended up flying the rest of the way. So tell me about your first meeting with Clark Rockefeller when you arrived at LaGuardia Airport.
Yeah, so I had a nervous breakdown, couldn't drive anymore in Minnesota, flew in to LaGuardia at night with the dog for the last leg. Clark Rockefeller had told me I'd recognize him because he was a dead ringer for the character of Niles on the show Frasier. And I looked around, and first I couldn't see him because he wasn't as tall as Niles, but then there was a guy in a pink polo shirt and a pink cap and loafers without socks. And he had this funny accent that I recognized from the phone. And he said, "Hello, Walter, you know, thank you, thank you." That's where the friendship began, the relationship.
Yeah. And you write in your book that you found Rockefeller to be instantly annoying. How so?
Well, he was amused by himself. You know, every word he spoke, you could tell he just savored and thought was the wittiest and most penetrating thing ever said. I thought, this guy's in love with himself.
Yeah, he was much more of a talker than a listener, right? Like, he didn't really ask you many questions about your trip or anything.
When I thought back over the relationship, I realized he rarely asked me any questions over a period of 10 years.
Wow.
But I also found out that he knew a lot more about me than I thought without asking questions, because he'd observed me very carefully.
How much did he pay you for bringing this disabled dog, Shelby, to New York for him?
Approximately 1/6 of what it actually cost to bring him the dog, $500, you know. I'd spent $500 just on the plane ticket from Minneapolis before, you know, the one-way plane ticket before going back. He gave me an envelope, and I refrained from opening it for a whole day because I wanted to fantasize about how big the check was.
Yeah, you were expecting Sorry, you were expecting another zero on the end, right? You were expecting $5,000.
Oh, yeah, yeah, exactly.
He's a Rockefeller, and
it had cost me $3,000, really, probably something close to that, just to take the trip. And so I was expecting a lot more, but I never said anything. I never said,
why not?
Oh,
didn't that raise red flags with you?
Low self-esteem? I mean, really, that sounds like a joke, but it's not. In his presence, having gone the next night after I delivered the dog to his private club, and then the day after, seen his huge art collection of expensive Rothkos and Pollocks in his apartment in New York, I kind of wanted to hang out with him. He was a fascinating character. I didn't want to confront him. I didn't want to have conflict at the very beginning of what I thought might be our friendship. I also had some notion that, you know, I was a gentleman and money was beneath us. I also still thought that maybe he'd make good on it with a contribution to the Humane Society and I shouldn't antagonize him. I mean, really, that was the moment where I failed myself.
Yeah, although you didn't realize that at the time. How much, you kind of touched on it there, Walter, how much of your friendship with Clark Rockefeller had to do with the fact that you thought he was a member of the upper class and he provided you with a way of becoming part of that world?
Well, you know, I really didn't need a way into that world in the sense that I'd met, not Rockefellers, but others of that sort of station and level of wealth before.
Yeah, you wrote a whole book about it, right? Your book, Lost in Meritocracy, when you went to Princeton.
I went to Princeton.
Yeah.
I went at Oxford. I knew Princess Diana's brother. I have a letter that I wrote to my mother from Oxford saying, you know, Princess Di's brother has invited me to Venice for the holiday, and I don't think I'll go. I'd rather stay here and read. and I didn't go. So, I mean, those types did captivate my imagination, but I wasn't, you know, I live in Montana, for heaven's sake. You know, I'm not obsessed with social climbing.
Mm-hmm.
But what did captivate me about him was his eccentricity and this kind of Gatsby-like mystery that he exuded. And so it was more my novelist's imagination that he captured. But I will say there was an element of self-satisfaction in knowing that I was a Rockefeller's good friend. Mm-hmm. And he would lay that on thick with me. He'd often say to me, oh, you're my best friend, or, you know, I trust you more than anyone else. You're the only one who's not trying to use me, and so on.
Mm-hmm. You mentioned his eccentricity. What were, can you give me an example of one of the most eccentric things that at the time you found charming?
Well, you know, charming or just interesting, he once said to me early on, I've never tasted a Coca-Cola, Walter. What does it taste like? You know, and my answer was brown and very sweet.
Yeah.
he said he'd never eaten in a restaurant. He didn't really know what a hamburger was. He didn't know what it tasted like. He told me he could sing the words to any song that I gave him to the tune of the theme from Gilligan's Island. He told me that he'd gone to Yale when he was 14. His parents were dead, and he was kind of a child prodigy. He claimed that he was doing research into speed of light or beyond speed of light interstellar propulsion systems at a secret lab in Canada. And he showed me kind of a picture of the lab. It was really just a picture of a forest. And in the trees, he said, was the lab hidden from satellite.
Right, but you couldn't make it out, right?
I couldn't make it out.
No, because it probably wasn't there. Yeah, one of the strangest moments in the time you spent with Clark Rockefeller was when you went to visit him while he was living in New Hampshire. Can you tell me about that?
Yeah. He had a house up in Cornish, New Hampshire. And it was nearby, he said, and I happen to know this was true, J.D. Salinger's house. J.D. Salinger, the great, you know, hermit of literature, lived near Clark Rockefeller. And Clark suggested to me that he knew Salinger and that if I ever came and visited him, we'd go over to his house and meet him. So that was one lure.
He never did take you over to Salinger's house, though, did he?
No. Yeah, well, so I go up to stay with him for the weekend in Cornish with Clark, and this mansion is, you know, formerly grand, but now completely under construction and drafty and without furniture and terribly uncomfortable. And I go out to dinner with him, and we, at the end of dinner, he says he doesn't have his wallet on him, and I get really sick of him while I'm on this visit. But he had lured me out there also with yet another promise of payment. He said he had been writing novels. He wouldn't tell me what they were about, and he wanted me to help edit them, and he'd pay me to do that. So I kind of went there for business reasons, too, I thought.
Mm-hmm. And also, you happened to mention to him that you were having some tax troubles, and he had kind of an interesting response, didn't he?
Yeah, while I was there, I said, oh, geez, I owe the IRS a couple $1,000s, and they're going to go into my bank account. I got a letter and take it. And he said, well, I can solve that. And he wrote down a phone number on a piece of paper and gave it to me. He said, here, call George. He'll handle it. And by George, he meant George Bush Jr., the president of the United States. And he assured me that if I called this number, it wouldn't be answered by a secretary. George himself, the president, would pick up the phone. Now, did that take, you know, a lot of brass or what? And he I think knew that I'd never dial that number.
Why not? Why not? Why weren't you tempted to call it?
Well, I was tempted, but here's what ran through my head. And this is the key to the psychology of being duped. First, I thought, if you call the president's phone number, it's obviously going to be traced. And I'll go on to some list, and, you know, they'll think I'm a security risk or something like that. Number two, when George Bush gave Clark this phone number, he probably didn't intend for him to hand it out to friends. And so I'm going to be asked where I got it, and I'll have to tell the authorities, and Clark will get in a lot of trouble. Best not to dial it. So I kept this piece of paper in my pocket, walking around, you know, completely befuddled and sort of numb in the brain to have such a thing, but not suspecting that he'd just made it up. I mean, who'd make that up?
Yeah. Well, I would.
But he did.
Yeah. But you write in the book that it looked official, whatever an official number for George W. Bush would look like.
Well, listen, yeah, exactly. Somebody writes down 10 numbers, you know, with an area code in front of them, and you know, they could tell you it was the, you know, number of Marlon Brando.
Yeah. How did you discover that Clark Rockefeller was not who he said he was?
Well, in 2008, in August, I'm in Montana working in my office, and I see on my computer, on the internet, that there's a nationwide Amber Alert. Clark Rockefeller is a wanted man. He's kidnapped his daughter from a street in downtown Boston after a custody hearing. And he has disappeared. I had been talking to Clark over the last year about his grief, or anger is a better word, at having lost custody of his daughter in a divorce. And because I was divorced too and didn't see my kids as much as I liked, we kind of comforted each other on this subject. When I saw that he'd kidnapped her, I thought, oh my Lord, he snapped. And though it was appalling, I kind of understood the level of emotion that might lead to it. A few days later, it came out that the Rockefellers were saying, he's not one of us. And I thought the Rockefellers were lying. I thought they're afraid of scandal and they're dissociating themselves. But then it came out, and the bad news just kept coming, that when he was caught, he was also a suspect in a murder from 1985, a gruesome, violent murder in California. And when I heard the details of the murder, for various reasons, I knew he was both guilty of it, and I knew I had been not just fooled, but in danger the whole time I'd known him.
Wow. So how did that make you feel?
It was like walking out and looking at the sun, and then having a big hand reach through the sky and rip it open, and you realize it's all a painting of the sky and the sun isn't real. I mean, it was like tumbling through space. I thought, my goodness, I can't trust my own judgment at all. And that was really hard on me. I mean, after that, simple things like giving a key to a plumber to your house so, you know, they can get in while you're gone became really hard. Meeting somebody on a blind date, who is she? You know, why am I supposed to trust that what she tells me is real? I mean, everything that became, everything that's easy about social life suddenly became hard because I suddenly realized everything's based on trust.
Yeah, and of course, not just social life, but especially your working life as a journalist, as, you know, someone who considers himself a good judge of character, that must have, that must have really hit you hard.
Well, it's funny, you know, being a journalist didn't help me in discerning Clark's true nature. And I think for this reason, when you are interviewing people as a journalist, you're both skeptical because you realize, you know, they might be manipulating you. And you're also sort of covering up your skepticism. You're trying to get them to speak. You're trying to get them to feel comfortable and so on.
Mm-hmm.
With Clark, I dropped the skepticism because I did it professionally. You know, who wants to be skeptical of their friends? That was what I did for a living. So it was nice to relax with people. Number two, because I was used to all kinds of outlandish characters and talking to them, I think he felt more comfortable with me than he would have with somebody who would have, you know, not bought his act.
Mm-hmm. So you're saying then that you're experience as a journalist made you more vulnerable to being duped by him. Would that be fair to say?
Well, think about it. Journalists are around politicians, for example, who are, you know, professional manipulators and to some extent very good deceivers. And you get used to it. I was used to characters and braggarts and, you know, colorful talkers.
In hearing your story, I can't help but think of Janet Malcolm's famous book, The Journalist and the Murderer. And in that book, Malcolm describes the journalist as a kind of confidence man, preying on people's vanity, ignorance, or loneliness, gaining their trust and betraying them without remorse. Do you think that's what was going on with you and Clark, or were the roles possibly reversed?
Well, it wasn't really what was going on at first. You know, when I got to New York after having decided I had to meet him because it would make a great story, I quickly decided I was not going to write about him. He was a real person. He valued his privacy. It wasn't fair to, break the confidence of a friendship. When I found out that he wasn't Clark Rockefeller and was indeed a murderer, all of that went by the wayside, and I thought, I am going to put this down in a book. I am going to lose my shyness. I am going to tell everything I know about my relationship with him. And I felt liberated by that. So for a while, I was being a very good, polite human being. But I stopped being one when I found out that he was a monster.
Huh. Yeah, your whole experience raises the question, can you ever really know another person? What do you think?
You can know a person to the extent to that to which that person is knowable. You can't know a sociopath. You can't know a psychopath because there's nothing to know about them. They assemble their personality in order to manipulate others. They create appearances, but beneath the appearances is nothing but their will to power, to take advantage, sometimes their will to cruelly hurt others. So you can know another person, but you cannot know a psychopath. There's nothing there. There's only one thing there, which is the hunger to control others.
Mm-hmm. At any cost, with no thought of morality or anything.
Yeah. Yes.
Yeah.
No memory even, you know, just move on from each horrible act to the other with no conscience.
Yeah. Did writing this book help you exercise the self-doubts, the low self-esteem, and or are you still struggling with these issues?
Well, you know, somebody said once, you know, writing isn't actually very good therapy because you know, it takes a long time, and it doesn't really cure you of anything. And this book helped me in this sense. When I finished it, I finally felt what I had felt underneath and had covered up the whole time I was with him, which was fear. Fear of his disapproval. Fear at some level of what I subconsciously knew maybe was his violent nature. Fear of him ridiculing me. Once I wrote the book, I realized that once I gave him the power of believing that he was, you know, sort of from a better social class and all these things, I had feared rejection by him, and I was no longer afraid of it. Now I court his rejection. I know he loathes me, and the feeling's mutual.
Mm. So do you live your life with more courage now? Is the fear gone? Are you more able to ask someone
on a date? I'd like to think so. I mean, I'd like to think so. But then again, you know, I had a pretty best case scenario. I got to see the person who'd fooled me for a decade tried for murder and convicted and put away for life. I mean, that satisfaction, let me tell you. And now I sound a little like a monster myself, but I'm only trying to be human and open about the fact that this kind of experience leaves you with a desire to get even. When I saw him go away to jail for life, though, I did feel a twinge of compassion. But you know what? I shouldn't have. People tell me that he'll do great in prison. He'll have a whole new audience and a whole new bag of tricks, and I'm pretty sure that's true.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. As you mentioned, you attended his murder trial. Can you tell me about that, what it was like to sit in the same courtroom? In the same room as him, because this had been the first time, had it not, since you found out
many years.
Who he really was. Yeah.
Yeah. So in 2013, exactly a year ago, I'm sitting in a downtown Los Angeles courtroom, probably about 10 feet from him. He asked the judge, if his lawyers asked the judge, if they would address him and the court would address him and refer to him as Mr. Rockefeller during the trial, even though that wasn't his name. It was Christian Karl Gerhardsreiter, his original German name.
Yeah. And he was originally from Germany, wasn't he?
He was originally from Germany. He'd come over to the U.S. at 17 and started posing as a fancy guy. Anyway, he dressed in a blue blazer and loafers without socks, and he dressed as this fake Rockefeller. After he was convicted, when he came in to be sentenced, of course, he was back in his orange prison jumpsuit. So it was really something to see someone who I had thought was such a, highfalutin character walk in with handcuffs in a orange prison uniform.
Yeah. Did that give you a feeling of satisfaction?
Well, a little bit. But I'll tell you, most of the trial I spent fearful that he wouldn't be convicted. Mm. I thought, this guy fooled me, he fooled the world, and now he's going to fool this jury. And, you know, my cynicism about the American media came out, and I thought, he's going to be on a talk show 2 weeks after this darn trial is over, making merry about his life of con artistry. He'll be a darn celebrity. He'll get a book deal. Mm. Well, I'm pretty glad that didn't happen.
Yeah. Did he ever look at you during the trial?
At the very first day when the jury was being selected, he turned around to look at one of the jurors who was being interviewed by the judge, and I was sitting right there. And he gave me this sort of wrinkled nostril, furrowed brow look of contempt and dismissal, like, I smelled bad, and what was I doing there? And, why was I betraying him?
Hmm. You visited him in jail. This was after the trial or during the trial?
After the trial. No, he was arrested for the kidnapping in 2008. And as of 2013, he'd been in jail the whole time and had never spoken to the press, never spoken to anyone. But the minute he was convicted, he fired his lawyers, and I found out that I was free to go visit him in prison, and so I did, and I resumed our relationship in prison.
Why? Why did you want to do that?
I wanted answers. He had denied his role in the murder during the whole trial, saying he was being, falsely accused. First of all, I wanted to walk in there and say, did you commit this murder? I also wanted him to look at me and confront the fact that somebody who he had fooled for all those years wasn't afraid of him.
Mm-hmm. What did he say when you asked him who committed the murder?
He said it was the wife who was missing, the wife of the victim, who's never been heard from since her husband died and is presumed by the prosecution to have died at the same time at Clark's hands. But Clark blamed her for the murder of her husband, yeah.
Mm. You also asked him what the key was to manipulating people. What did he tell you?
Yeah, I said, well, if you're not going to confess to the murder, at least tell me this. How do you con people? How do you fool people? How do you take advantage? And he said, it's three simple words, all the same word, vanity, vanity, vanity. You play on people's vanity.
Have you heard whether he's heard about your book, read it?
Well, it was only last August, August 25th, I believe, that he was finally sentenced to life in prison. And I interviewed him in the courtroom after the sentencing. The judge allowed a few people to talk to him. And by that time, I had written a piece for The New Yorker about his trial, which he had read. And he looked at me, and his first words were, "You betrayed me, Walter." Huh. And I wanted to say, I wanted to laugh, you know, mm-hmm. but actually, instead I felt guilty for a second, and then I went, wait a minute, man, don't go back to that. Remember, you're telling the truth, and he's not.
Yeah, yeah. Well, was all the time and the emotional investment you put into this friendship worth the story that came out of it? Can we look at it that way?
You know, a writer has a killer instinct even about his own life. Absolutely, it was worth it. I mean, you know, you're going to get your damage in life somehow. none of us get out of here alive and unscathed, and we all have lessons to learn, and it's a writer's job to take the particular lessons that are visited upon she or he and make the most of them. So the only thing that would have been a shame is if I hadn't found a way to write about it. Then I would have felt a sense of loss. Mm-hmm. That sounds cold-blooded in a way, and it is.